You're listening to the Restless Wanderer podcast by Paul Coulter, and this is part one of a series in the Book of Esther. Esther chapter 1, verse 1. Now in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces, in those days when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa, the capital, in the third year of his reign he gave a feast for all his officials and servants. The army of Persia and Media and the nobles and governors of the provinces were before him, while he showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendour and pomp of his greatness for many days, 180 days. And when these days were completed, the king gave for all the people present in Susa, the citadel, both great and small, a feast lasting for 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were white cotton curtains and violet hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rods and marble pillars, and also couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. Drinks were served in golden vessels, vessels of different kinds, and the royal wine was lavished according to the bounty of the king, and drinking was according to this edict: there is no compulsion, for the king had given orders to all the staff of his palace to do as each man desired. Queen Vashti also gave a feast for the women in the palace that belonged to King Ahasuerus. We'll pause our reading there at the end of verse 9 of Esther chapter 1. Now, this short book of Esther is quite an intriguing book in the Bible, in the Old Testament. And perhaps the greatest, the most intriguing reason for it is that it is the one book of the Old Testament that definitely doesn't mention the name of God directly. There's also a question mark over the book of Song of Songs or Song of Solomon. If you look at that book, chapter 8, verse 6, you'll see a footnote which says that that might be interpreted or translated to include the name of God. So it's possible that we have two books, though, that don't contain God's name directly, but certainly Esther doesn't. And that might seem odd to us. How can we have a whole book of the Bible that doesn't refer to God? But although I've said that God is not directly mentioned by this book, it's quite clear that this book does belong within the Old Testament. There are lots of things in this book, as we'll see when we go through it, that make reference to other parts of the Old Testament and to the history of the nation of Israel. And God is clearly active. There are hints or pointers in the book that show us that it is God who's preserving his people. Esther is recognized by scholars of Jewish writings and of ancient texts as a masterful book of storytelling. It's quite a dramatic story, and it really is highly engaging. It's, as you read it, you'll see that it's beautifully crafted with all sorts of suspense built into it and twists and turns. And that has led some people to think maybe this book is a fiction, not a historical book. But as we'll see, it does parallel actual historic events. And so we're not dealing here with something that's just a made-up story, but something that happens at a point in history, and particularly the history of the Jewish people. It's events that give rise, in fact, to a new festival for the Jewish people, as we'll see towards the end of the book, the festival of Purim, which was to do with the deliverance of the Jews. It's a festival that isn't commanded in the Old Testament in the books of Moses, like the other festivals given to Israel, tabernacles and Passover and the other various festivals. But it is a festival that became important for the Jewish people. And the explanation for that festival is that it dates from the events of this book. And this book is also important in the unfolding of the history of the Bible, because it happens, or its events happen, in a key period of history. If you're familiar with Old Testament history, you'll know that the Israelites, the southern kingdom of Judah, which remained after the northern kingdom was destroyed and its people taken into exile by the Assyrians in 722 BC, Well, the southern kingdom carried on for some time until finally Jerusalem fell in 586 BC under Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon. He first invaded Jerusalem and Judah in 606 BC and took some people like Daniel off as exiles. He came back again in 597, but finally destroyed the city in 586. And that began a period of captivity for the people of Judah. First of all, under the Babylonians, and then subsequently, the Persians defeated the Babylonians. And a king called Cyrus II, king of Persia, was able to defeat Babylon in 539 BC. And the Persians became the dominant empire in that part of the world. And it's in the Persian era that Esther is located. But why is it particularly significant? Well, because the Persians allowed the people of the Jewish people to return to Jerusalem. They first returned in about 536 BC under a man called Zerubbabel, who was a descendant of David. And you can read about that in the book of Ezra, chapters 1 to 6. But then there was a period of time when some of these Jewish people had returned. Others were still living in Babylon, which was an important city now under the Persians. And really, the most famous Old Testament events in the return from exile, which were under Ezra himself and then Nehemiah, they happened in the middle of the 400s BC. So that's Ezra returning about 458 BC, that's 80 years after Zerubbabel, and then Nehemiah another 14 years or so later. And if you want to read about that, read the book of Nehemiah and Ezra chapters 7 to 10. So it's important to realise that this return from exile happened in three waves. First of all, in the mid-500s with Zerubbabel, then in the mid-400s with Ezra, and a little bit later, a third time with Nehemiah. Why am I emphasising that? Well, because Esther is located bang, well, not quite in the middle, but in that period between the first return under Zerubbabel and the second return under Ezra. And, of course, Esther is giving us a unique insight into that time period. No other Bible book tells us about that period of time. We have some of the prophetic books that are happening or recording God's messages to his people at the time of Zerubbabel, the same time as Ezra 1 to 6, the books of Haggai and Zechariah, when the temple was being rebuilt. We have Nehemiah's account of the walls being rebuilt later on, and the prophet Malachi comes around that time. But Esther is the only book of the Bible that deals with this time between the two returns, or the first and second return. And Esther, how do we know that? Well, because Esther is located, as we've just read in Esther 1, under the king Ahasuerus. Now, Ahasuerus is one of four main characters in this book. There is Ahasuerus, there is Haman, the Agagite, who is an official under Ahasuerus, and there is Esther, of course, who gives her name to the book, and her uncle, Mordecai. So two Jews, two non-Jews. Now, of those four people, really, we can't reliably identify three of them from historical records because, and that's not unexpected, the historical records for this period of time are quite patchy. And so it's not a surprise that we can't identify Haman or Mordecai or even Esther. But we can identify the king, Ahasuerus, as you would expect. But he's not known to history primarily by that name, but by the name Xerxes. Now, I'm not at all au fait with the languages of Persia or even of Hebrew, but I'm reliably informed that the same Persian name, Ahasuerus or Xerxes, the same Persian name can give us both of those names. I suppose if you pause and think, Ahasuerus, you get the two S sounds. Xerxes, you get an X, which sounds like an S and an S at the end. And so these are really two variations of the same name. The King Xerxes was the son of King Darius I, And he reigned from 486 to 464 BC. So a period of around 30 years. And the Book of Esther tells us when the book is set. It opens in this chapter that we've just read in the third year of the reign of Ahasuerus or Xerxes. And that's significant because we know from other historical accounts, particularly the Greek historian Herodotus, who wrote about the Persian Wars. He, as a Greek, was very interested in the Persians because Xerxes, as you may know, is well known to history as someone who tried to invade Greece. But when Ahasuerus or Xerxes became king, there was a period of instability for the first 3 years or 2 and a bit years of his reign. He had to confirm his grip on the kingdom. He had to stabilize his rule because there were a number of rivals to his throne. And so this Book of Esther fits perfectly with what we know from those histories because, of course, now in his third reign, he has a stable kingdom and a stable grip on the kingdom. And he's celebrating that fact exactly as you might expect that a king in that time would. And he does it with great grandeur, glory, and splendor and pomp of his greatness, it says in verse 4, for 180 days. This is a ridiculously lavish festival. He provides food not only for his nobles and governors, all 127 of them from India to Ethiopia, a vast empire, but also for all of the people of the citadel of Susa, his capital, which both the great and the small, and he gives them a feast of 7 days after the 180 days for him and his nobles. So this is an immense outpouring of wealth, and we get this account of some of the furnishings of the citadel and of the palace in verse 6, white cotton, violet, fine linen and purple, silver rods, marble pillars, gold and silver pavements, or couches rather, and pavements of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. This is a mighty and wealthy king, and he's now celebrating the fact that his kingdom is at peace. Now, the other date that is significant, though, is when we get into chapter 2, when Esther comes on the scene, and when Esther becomes the queen of Ahasuerus, we find that that happens in the 7th year of his reign, chapter 2, verse 16. And that's significant because what Xerxes is doing in between the 3rd year and the 7th year is invading Greece. And we know this from history. He took a period of time to prepare his invasion. And he was initially successful in that invasion. He was able to destroy or conquer the city of Athens, which at that time, of course, Greece was not one unified country, but a collection of city-states and these kingdoms surrounding them. So he's able to defeat the Athenians, but then he is defeated himself, or his army is, at Salamis, the Battle of Salamis, which took place in 480 BC. And that was a naval battle where the Greek fleet defeated the Persian naval forces. It was really the turning point for Xerxes. It wasn't his final battle in Greece. He tried to continue his invasion, but 1 year later, in 479 BC, there was a second defeat at the Battle of Plataea, and that was really the end of his invasion. So remember, I said Xerxes came to the throne in 486. His defeat that turned him away from Greece was in 479, the 7th year of his reign. And that's when he is back on the scene in Esther chapter 2, taking Esther as his queen. So this biblical account fits perfectly with those other historical sources, and we're able to identify Ahasuerus with Xerxes, the Persian king. And we're able to locate the book, as I've said, in this window between the first return under Zerubbabel and the second return under Ezra, because Xerxes reigns until 486, sorry, 464 BC, and it is 458, 6 years later, that Ezra himself is able to return under Artaxerxes, who was king after Xerxes and son of Xerxes. Now, again, I presume some of you have probably been lost in the history, but what I'm trying to do is to establish when this happened and why the events of Esther are important, because what Esther is telling us about, and Esther as the character was involved in, is the rescue of the Jewish people at a time when they are vulnerable. They're vulnerable because they are a small minority in a mighty empire that spreads across a huge region of the world from India to Ethiopia. They have, since the return under Zerubbabel, they have a presence in the city of Jerusalem in one of the provinces. But of course, that's their primary base, if you like. But there are Jews still in the city of Susa and in other cities of the empire and in other provinces. And the reality is that because they are under the Persians, they are vulnerable. If the Persians decide to wipe them out, really there are no or very few Jews living outside the Persian Empire. So there is a vulnerability. And there's a character, Haman, who comes on the scene, who is determined to destroy the Jews. His reasons for that we'll see as we get into the book, but we shouldn't miss the fact that there's also a biblical background to Haman and to his ancestry, which I'll explain when we meet him in chapter 3. So here is a point when the Jews are vulnerable, and God is going to work behind the scenes, yes, unnamed in the book, but to bring about the deliverance of his people. And Esther is the agent. Esther and Mordecai are the agent of that deliverance. And Esther is a wonderful, a beautiful example of wisdom in the Old Testament. She's perhaps one of the prime examples of a wise person. She personifies many of the qualities of biblical wisdom that we read about in books like Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, that whole section of the wisdom literature. Esther is, of all characters in the Old Testament, perhaps the greatest example of that. Now, we haven't read about Esther yet in chapter 1. We have read about Ahasuerus, and we've read about his queen Vashti. We can't identify her from history either, but that's not necessarily a surprise, because this king Xerxes has a harem, as we'll find out in the book. He has many queens and concubines and so on, and in fact when he comes back from Greece we find him taking refuge amongst his harem. He gives up leading his armies, and it's not that his armies don't try to conquer other regions, but Xerxes will no longer be going to war. He's going to find solace amongst his harem. So Vashti at this point is his lead queen, if you like, but she's one amongst many wives, and Esther also becomes one, well, the prime one amongst many wives. So Queen Vashti at this point is prime, and she gives a feast for the women in the palace that belonged to King Ahasuerus, according to verse 9. Let's read on then into verse 10 of Esther chapter 1. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Bizbiztha, Harbona, Bigtha, and Abagtha, Zethar and Carcass, the seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown, in order to show the peoples and the princes her beauty, for she was lovely to look at. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. At this the king became enraged, and his anger burned within him. Then the king said to the wise men who knew the times, for this was the king's procedure towards all who were versed in law and judgment, the men next to him being Karshena, Sethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Meres, Marsena, and Memucan, the seven princes of Persia and Media, who saw the king's face and sat first in the kingdom. According to the law, what is to be done to Queen Vashti, because she has not performed the command of King Ahasuerus delivered by the eunuchs? Then Memucan said in the presence of the king and the officials, Not only against the king has Queen Vashti done wrong, but also against all the officials and all the peoples who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behaviour will be made known to all women, causing them to look at their husbands with contempt, since they will say, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she did not come. This very day, the noble women of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's behaviour will say the same to all the king's officials, and there will be contempt and wrath in plenty. If it please the king, let a royal order go out from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it may not be repealed, that Vashti is never again to come before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. So when the decree made by the king is proclaimed throughout all his kingdom, for it is vast, all women will give honour to their husbands, high and low alike. This advice pleased the king and the princes, and the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent letters to all the royal provinces, to every province in its own script, and to every people in its own language, that every man be master in his own household, and speak according to the language of his people. We'll end our reading there at the end of Esther chapter 1. That's the end of verse 22. Now, just to say that we get another little insight into the nature of the Persian Empire here in these verses. We see that the king doesn't only use one official language, Persian, but in fact he sends letters in the script and language of each of the peoples of his various provinces. The Persian Empire was different from the Babylonian Empire before it and the Assyrian Empire before that. These were the three successive dominant powers in the region of Mesopotamia who are dominant in the Old Testament, alongside Egypt, which of course is further west and south. So to the southwest of the land of Israel, you had Egypt. To the northeast, you had these powers who were dominant successively, the Assyrians, the Babylonians or Chaldeans or Neo-Babylonians, and the Persians or Persians and Medes, because as you've seen in this chapter, the Medes, who had been a power to the east of Babylon, had been conquered by the Persians. And so you have this united kind of empire of Media and Persia. Now, the Persians are different from the previous rulers, the Assyrians and the Neo-Babylonians, because they allow their regions to have a little bit more cultural autonomy. They're more multicultural in their approach. And that's significant in Bible history because the Assyrians were dominant when the Northern Kingdom, it was they who defeated the Northern Kingdom, that's often called Israel in the Bible. And their approach was to mix up the people, to take those people away and put new people into the land. And so the people who were exiled from the Northern Kingdom lost their distinctive identity. The Babylonians, their approach was to take away the elites from each nation they conquered and to assimilate those people into their elite in their capital. So in the book of Daniel, you read about Daniel and his friends being given Babylonian names and educated in the ways of Babylon and expected to eat its food and certainly dress in its clothing. But the Persians, that's why they allowed people to go back to Jerusalem and rebuild the temple. They allowed a greater degree of multiculturalism, if you like. They allowed each region to have its own distinctive language and culture to a greater degree. And so we see that reflected in this passage. Of course, God was behind the rising and falling of those different nations with their different policies of empire and in taking his people into exile, bringing judgments differently on the Northern Kingdom and on the Southern Kingdom, preserving the Jews and then allowing them to come back by bringing the Persians to the fore. But of course, the dominant thing that we see in this passage is, well, two things really. Ahasuerus, for all of his pomp and circumstance, is a weak figure. He tends to follow whichever advisor has his ear at the time. He doesn't know what to do about Queen Vashti's refusal to come. Now, at one level, that seems silly. This is a king. He has immense power. Why does he not just take revenge on her? I mean, she doesn't end up being punished, but what he does is write this letter for fear that the reputation of what she's done would have an impact across his empire. And he only does it because this man, Memucan, who's one of the officials who the king summons, suggests it to him, gives him the words. So here is a king who, yes, on the surface is powerful, but who in terms of his personal decisiveness is weak. Now, this is the characterization of Xerxes in the Book of Esther. We also know from history that he was a cruel and ruthless man, particularly in his military conquests. But at this point, of course, this is before those conquests, in his own home city. But the other thing that's dominant here, of course, is the attitude to women. This is outrageous that a wife would refuse to do her husband's bidding, not just because her husband is the king, but because he's her husband. And wives should obey the whim and will of their husbands. It's a very negative view of women. It is a very patriarchal society, if you like, and it's a situation where men are using their superior power, because the culture gives them that power, to keep their women in subjection. And so this woman is supposed to do what she's told. When she doesn't do what she's told, it's causing fear amongst the other princes and advisors that all the women might suddenly rebel against their husbands and treat them with contempt. And so the king's letter is telling wives to obey their husbands. It seems very foreign, doesn't it, to the culture that we live in today? Although even today we're aware of how this battle between the sexes for control and supremacy continues to rage. And we can see still plenty of evidence of men abusing women through physical abuse or occupying positions of power. The other thing to say, though, is that Vashti for the king seems to be little more than a trophy. He's going to parade her in front of his guests. He wants her to bring her royal crown and to show off her beauty. And we'll see that Esther herself is also caught up in that expectation. When we get into chapter 2, it's almost like a beauty, one of those horrendous beauty pageants that objectify women. And even though women are prepared to take part in them, I have to say, I think they are objectifying and demeaning to women. But despite the fact that Esther is caught up in that system, as I've said already, and as we will see, she shines through this book in her wisdom. And of course, it's a much more positive view of a woman than the view in the Persian court. Esther, despite being in a sense a victim of her time, is able to show wisdom that comes from God. And that, of course, is the biblical view of women. Women are equal with men in terms of their status and their relationship with God. And you only need to read parts of the Old Testament, like the last chapter or the last chapters of Proverbs, to see just how a wise woman is extolled. You read the Gospels and you see women who were faithful followers of Jesus and the supreme examples of faith and faithfulness. You see that too in the commendations of the epistles. So the Bible, God's word, although it has different roles for men and women, it doesn't ignore the difference between them. It acknowledges those differences and has different expectations of men and women. It treats them both as equal in the sight of God, unlike the Persian culture. So we can look at this and think that's outrageous, but the Bible is not condoning it. It's just describing the way things were. A woman who is treated as an object of beauty and presumably of sexual desire, whether she resists because there is something demeaning in this, I think it's demeaning in itself, but whether it was more than that, whether there was some sexual undertone to this demand that she come, certainly at a drunken party, she might have had good reason to think that she was vulnerable and would not be treated well. But whether that's the case or whether it's simply that she's had enough of being treated like a trophy, it's quite significant that she resists but also significant that the king doesn't know how to respond without his advisors, and even then his response is rather weak, I suppose, for an ancient despotic ruler. So we've introduced the Book of Esther and its times. We'll find out more about Esther herself in the next episode.